Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Work moves fast. From emails and reports to proposals and updates, you're expected to think clearly, write confidently, and get it right the first time. And every message counts. That's where Grammarly comes in. It gives you everything you need to think, write, and finish in one place, or anywhere you type and text. You'll never have to switch tools or tabs. Grammarly's AI agents are built for how you work and where you work, so you can find the right words, adjust your tone, and predict how your message might land before you hit send. Your ideas will get a boost while still sounding natural, credible, and just the way you want. For nearly 17 years, Grammarly has been the standard for responsible AI. It's the premier writing tool that 93% of users trust to get more work done. In a world of generic AI, don't sound like everyone else. With Grammarly, you never will. Download Grammarly for free at Grammarly.com. That's Grammarly.com.
Hello and welcome back to this episode of Epochs, where once again I shall be continuing my narrative of the decline and fall of the Roman Republic. Now, last time, if you remember, we're getting to the most juicy bit, the start of the actual civil war itself. In fact, it has basically kicked off at the end of last episode when I talked about Caesar crossing the Rubicon. So let's continue straight from there. In Plutarch's Life of Pompey, he says this, quote, "A few days later, Caesar entered and occupied Rome. He did what he could to calm people's fears and behaved with great moderation to everyone, except in the case of Metellus, one of the tribunes, who tried to prevent him taking money out of the public treasury." Caesar badly needed money at this point. "Caesar threatened to have Metellus put to death and followed up with the threat with language of even greater truculence. It was much easier for him," he said, "to do this than to say it." I could order you killed quicker than it takes to actually kill you. "So with Metellus overruled in this way, Caesar took what he wanted from the treasury and then set out in pursuit of Pompey, since he wanted to drive him out of Italy before his forces in Spain could come to join him. Meanwhile, Pompey had occupied Brundisium. He found plenty of transports there and immediately put the consuls and 30 cohorts of soldiers on board the ships and sent them across before him to Dyrrhachium. He sent his father-in-law Scipio and his son Gnaeus to Syria to raise a fleet. He himself barricaded the gates and stationed the most lightly armed soldiers on the walls. He told the citizens of Brundisium to stay quiet in their houses and then dig up all the ground inside the city, cutting trenches across the streets and filling them with stakes sunk in the earth, all except for two streets, by which in the end he made his way down to the sea. He spent 2 days in embarking the main body of his troops in a quiet and orderly manner, and on the third day suddenly gave the signal to men who were guarding the walls. They hurried down quickly, were taken aboard and brought across to Dyrrhachium. Caesar, seeing the walls unguarded, realised that Pompey was making his escape, and in following closely after him, he nearly got his own troops entangled in the ditches and stakes. The people of Brundisium, however, warned him about them, and so he kept clear of the city and wheeled around it to the harbour, where he found that all the transports had put to sea, except two, which had only a few soldiers on board." End quote. So Pompey gets away there by the skin of his teeth. He was very nearly caught at Brundisium before jumping across the Adriatic. But he did escape, and he has got the word out to everyone in the east and west that it's on now, that he is at war with Caesar. So, you know, he gets messages to his legions stationed in Spain. And if you remember last time, he'd sent word out to everyone in the east, all his clients and client kingdoms in the east, to start raising and mustering men on his behalf. Plutarch goes on saying, quote, "Most people hold the view that this withdrawal of Pompey can be considered among his most remarkable military achievements. Caesar himself, however, was astonished that he abandoned and surrendered Italy when he was based on a strong city, was expecting his forces from Spain, and had complete control of the seas. Cicero also finds fault with him," Pompey that is, "for following the strategy of Themistocles rather than that of Pericles, when the position in which he found himself was like that of Pericles and not like that of Themistocles. And Caesar certainly showed by his actions that he very much feared the idea of a long war. For after he had captured Numerius, a friend of Pompey, he sent him to Brundisium with an offer of peace and reconciliation on fair and equal terms. Numerius, however, sailed away with Pompey. Caesar, who without bloodshed had in 60 days become the master of the whole of Italy, would have liked to have followed after Pompey at once, but there were no transports available, and so he turned back and marched into Spain, wishing to bring over to himself the soldiers of Pompey who were stationed there. End quote. So that's actually quite a big, important strategic decision Caesar makes there. He sees that Pompey, the senior Pompey, because Pompey's sons become important later, but the main Pompey, the Pompey Magnus, just escapes from him at Brundisium, escapes across to what is would be Epirus or modern day Albania, Greece. Instead of attempting to follow him as quickly as he possibly can, he makes the, as I say, strategic decision to actually abandon that chase and go west into Spain and take out his Pompey's armies there. You know, because fighting on two fronts is always a nightmare. It's always the last thing you want is to be in a pincer, is to be being attacked from two sides at once. So Caesar made the calculation, and you can only say correctly, that he needed to do away with the Spanish armies first and foremost. And then he can turn his full attention back to Pompey Magnus without fear that he might have to turn around at one point. Appian tells us this at this point, quote, "Some of Pompey's army had sailed with the consuls to Dyrrhachium, but he assembled the rest at Brundisium to wait for the return of the ships, which had taken the consuls across. He beat off Caesar's attacks on the walls and dug trenches in the streets until his fleet came back. He then put out to sea in the early evening, leaving his bravest men on the walls, who themselves sailed out with a fair wind when the night fell. In this way, Pompey left Italy and crossed to Epirus with his entire army. Caesar was baffled as to which way to turn and from what point to start the campaign. He saw that support was flowing to Pompey from all quarters. Men, materiel, money, Pompey and the Senate's influence and resources were vast, obviously much bigger than Caesar's. And he was afraid that Pompey's army in Spain, which was large and well-trained through long service, would attack him from the rear if he pursued Pompey. So he decided to march to Spain and destroy it first, but divided his force into five. To protect Italy, he left one detachment in Brundisium, one in Hydruntum, and one in Tarentum. He sent another force under Quintus Valerius to take possession of the grain-producing island of Sardinia, and Asinius Pollio to Sicily. Here Cato was in charge, and when Cato inquired whether it was from the Senate or the people that he had authority to trespass in another man's sphere, Pollio replied, 'The master of Italy has sent me on this errand.' Cato answered to the effect that out of consideration for the provincials, he would make no resistance, and sailed to Corsaira, and thence to join Pompey." So Cato ousted from his little bolt hole in Sicily quite easily there. He obviously realised Caesar wouldn't just leave him alone, wouldn't allow him just to be governor quietly there for a year or two. So he realises he has to fully, Cato this is, he realises he has to sort of fully side with Pompey, completely be in Pompey's military camp, basically. There's no, you can run, but you can't hide from Caesar if he decides he's not going to leave you alone. Appian continues, "Caesar made haste to Rome, where with a variety of hopes and promises, he reassured the people, who were terrified by the recollection of their sufferings at the hands of Sulla and Marius, and signalled his generosity towards his enemies by pointing out that he had captured and dismissed even Lucius Domitius, one of Caesar's worst enemies, really. He had dismissed Lucius Domitius unharmed and with his money. He broke open the locks of the state treasury, and when Metellus, one of the tribunes, tried to prevent him, threatened him with death. He also removed some of the untouchable money, which is said to have been deposited a long time ago for use against the Gauls, with a public curse against its disturbance for any other reason than the outbreak of a Gallic war." So a special fund in a temple there, special big cache of money meant for defending themselves in extreme cases against the Gauls. But Caesar says, "You don't really need that anymore after what I just did to the Gauls." Appian continues, "Caesar, however, claimed that he had himself neutralised the Gauls and released Rome from the curse. Therefore, he can just take that money. He put Marcus Aemilius in charge of the city, and the tribune Mark Antony in charge of Italy and its military forces. Overseas, he appointed Curio governor of Sicily in place of Cato. Quintus, governor of Sardinia, sent Gaius Antonius to Illyria and entrusted Cisalpine Gaul to Licinius Crassus. He also gave orders for two fleets to be built as quickly as possible on the Adriatic and Tyrrhenian coasts, and appointed as admirals Hortensius and Dolabella while the ships were still under construction. So now we enter a period, a fairly brief period, or a few months, a year or so, where both sides are sort of getting everything together for a big confrontation. Both sides sort of fairly feverishly working to build up the biggest army they possibly can for what's sure to come. Appian goes on saying, quote, "After strengthening Italy in this way to make it inaccessible to Pompey, Caesar proceeded to Spain, where he met Pompey's generals, Petrarius and Afranius. In the first engagements against them, he had the worst of it, but later they fought on nearly equal terms around the town of Ilerda. Caesar made camp on some crags and obtained supplies by a bridge over the river Sicoris. After a sudden flood had swept away the bridge, Petrarius's men killed a large number of Caesar's troops, who were cut off on the other side, and Caesar himself, along with the rest of his army, suffered intense hardship from the difficult terrain and hunger and enemy action and the fact it was still winter. The operation was indistinguishable from a siege until, with the arrival of summer, Afranius and Petrarius started to march to the interior of Spain to recruit more soldiers. Caesar always anticipated them, blocking off the passes with entrenchments, preventing them from going on, and actually surrounding a detachment of theirs, which had been sent ahead to occupy a site for a camp. These raised their shields above their heads in token of surrender, but Caesar neither took them prisoner nor put them to death. Instead, he bid for popularity with his enemies everywhere by letting them go back safely to Afranius's army. As a result, there was constant fraternization between the camps, and among the rank and file, talk of an understanding." So it's important to note there, Caesar constantly playing the propaganda game, or the battle for the hearts and minds. He is constantly letting people go. He's constantly not executing people and letting them have their freedom. Remember, he did it to Domitius straight away. As soon as the war kicked off, the Senate sent Domitius up to relieve Caesar of his command. Caesar captured him, remember, and then just let him go and even let him keep his money. So a fairly extreme clemency, really. Very, very, very merciful for the ancient world, for a civil war. You would have thought at least detained certain people until the war is over. But Caesar's just letting people go, whole armies go, really. Like in Spain here, for example, there was, you know, he's basically bested a couple of Pompey's generals there, sort of out-generaling them, as usual, cutting them off and making sure they haven't got enough water and things, and bringing them to heel quite quickly, but just letting them go. And it's the exact opposite of what Pompey's doing. Pompey and the Senate's faction, quite often when they get hold of pro-Caesarian officers or something, they will just execute them, like it's the old school Marius Sulla days. So, I mean, the juxtaposition there of Caesar being extremely clement and Pompey being relatively, well, or not even cruel, just par for the course in the ancient world, really. Still, if you were undecided or you were thinking about changing sides, you're much more likely to go with someone like Julius Caesar, right, who's almost certainly going to let you live, maybe even not punish you whatsoever, rather than Pompey, who may, not Pompey himself, but Pompey's faction, may treat you extremely harshly. But it is a bit of a double-edged sword, Caesar's clemency, because you could forgive someone and let them go, and then find months or a year or two down the line, or whatever, that they're back on the battlefield standing against you again. Not just officers, but just normal rank and file men as well. They can promise that they'll never raise arms against you ever again, but if you just completely let them go, then they might do. And many did. Also, Tom Holland in Rubicon talks about, and he's not the only one to have noticed this, but there is something fairly sharp-edged with Caesar's clemency. It's not sort of pure altruism. It's not just because he's a completely nice guy. It is a calculated political thing. Because, you know, particularly in this period of ancient Rome, it was disgraceful to owe your life to somebody else's good graces. You know, if Caesar pardons you for crimes, which you, by rights, probably should be exiled or executed for, if Caesar just waves a hand of clemency and you're allowed to live, well, there is something a bit humiliating in that. You know, that it still shows that your life is just a plaything, a toy for him to discard as he sees fit. So whilst you might get away with your life and even your freedom, you don't get away with your honour really intact. Tom Holland talks about that Domitius being diminished after being pardoned by Caesar, being humbled and humiliated, really. You know, Caesar's playing a ruthless game with his mercy. So Appian left off saying that there was fraternisation among the Pompeian and Caesarian troops. Because remember, these people would have known each other, or some of them would have known each other. They were certainly on the same side until just a few months ago. So of course there will be fraternisation. It's fraternisation between national enemies which don't know each other's language sometimes. So amongst Romans, even brothers in arms, some of them, some Caesarian troops would have fought alongside some Pompeian troops in the past. So there's fraternisation. Appian says, quote, "As for the senior officers, Afranius and others thought they should abandon Spain to Caesar and get away unscathed to join Pompey. But Petrarius disagreed and raced through the camp, killing any of Caesar's men he could find fraternising, and personally putting to death one of his own officers who tried to stop him. Consequently," again, so Pompey's side, getting a reputation for bloodthirstiness and executions. "Consequently, the soldiers were still further angered by the grimness of Petrarius, and their sympathies turned towards Caesar and his generosity." Yeah, no kidding. "Then, in a place where Caesar had prevented his opponents even from getting water, Petrarius, who was at his wit's end, came with Afranius to negotiate with Caesar in full view of the two watching armies. The agreement was that they, for their part, would abandon Spain to Caesar, while Caesar would escort them unharmed to the river Var and allow them to make their way from there to join Pompey." So he's even letting some of the senior people that murdered some of his men, deliberately letting them get back to Pompey. "When he reached the river, Caesar called a meeting of those of them whose homes were in Rome or Italy and addressed them as follows. 'Enemies, I still use the word to make my point clear to you. I did not kill either those of you who were sent ahead to Caesar's site for a camp and surrendered to me, or the rest of your army after I had blocked your access to water, in spite of the fact that Petrarius had previously slaughtered some of my men, who were cut off on the opposite side of the Sicoris. If you feel any gratitude to me for these actions, let all Pompey's soldiers know about them.' With these words, he dismissed them and appointed Quintus Cassius to govern Spain." End quote. So he's saying, look, you can go, but my main stipulation in letting you free is that you spread the word that I let you go. So Caesar knows that there's many levels to this civil war, right? There's fighting battles, which are, of course, the key, arguably the most pivotal thing, but not necessarily the most pivotal thing. If you keep having indecisive battles or something, or if the enemy kept refusing battle, then there's whole other aspects to this war, to most wars. Again, that battle for the hearts and minds of the people. Public opinion. He wants the establishment in Rome and the wider Roman world to know that he's not a Sulla, that he's not this bloodthirsty, crazy tyrant that Cato and the Senate have painted him to be. That's sort of his main PR objective. The optics of being a good and generous ruler and not some blood-soaked monster. Okay, Appian goes on. "So much for Caesar's operations. In Africa, Attius Varus was the Pompeian commanding officer, and allied with him was the Numidian king Juba. On Caesar's side, Curio sailed from Sicily to attack them with 2 legions, 12 warships, and a large number of merchantmen. Putting in at Utica, he routed a new Numidian cavalry in a brief engagement near the town and consented to accept a salutation as imperator from his troops while their weapons were still in their hands." Bit presumptuous, that, from Curio. I wouldn't suspect Caesar would like that. And Appian reminds us, "It is a great honour for a general to be so saluted by his army, as though his men are certifying that he is a commander worthy of them. In the past, this honour was accepted by generals for any great success, but I am informed that the qualification is now 10,000 enemy dead. While Curio was still on his way across from Sicily, his opponents in Africa, expecting that his ambition would make him occupy Scipio's camp because of the splendour of Scipio's great achievements, poisoned the water there. Nor were they disappointed, as Curio took up his position there and his troops immediately fell sick. When they drank the water, their vision became fogged and a deep torpid sleep ensued, which was followed by frequent vomiting and spasms affecting the whole body. Because of this, Curio moved his camp alongside Utica itself, leading his army, weakened by ill health, through a formidable and extensive marsh. When the news of Caesar's victory in Spain reached them, their morale recovered, and they were drawn up for battle in a restricted space by the sea. In the fierce fight which ensued, Curio lost one man to Varus's 600 dead and an even greater number of wounded. So we can see that there's theatres going on, obviously, in the east. We're just going to talk about Greece and Thrace and Epirus, but also in Spain, also in North Africa. So when Caesar crossed the Rubicon, it really started a type of ancient Mediterranean world war. There's not just going to be one battle between Caesar and Pompey. It's across the entire Roman world. Pompey's faction is much bigger than Pompey. I mean, you can argue that Caesar's faction is sort of Caesar. Obviously, there's lots more people to it, and it survives after his own death. But it is a much smaller clique or faction and more based around the name Caesar, whereas Pompey's side of the equation is sort of the entire Roman state. Of course, it's not a modern state as we have them, but you know what I mean by that. The institutions of the entire Roman world can and were, it seems, brought to bear against Caesar from the Atlantic to the Euphrates. So Caesar's got to put out fires all over the place, hunting down and defeating Pompey himself. Is only the first head of the Hydra. And more than once, Caesar has to put out fires all over the Roman world.
If you'd like to see the full version of this premium video, please head over to lotuseaters.com and subscribe to gain full access to all of our premium content.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.